Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says Tehran doesn't intend to leave talks on the revival of the JCPOA, but will not back down from its stance in the negotiations. Meanwhile, Iran's top security official says his country will continue remedial measures in the nuclear sector as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed. Also, the U.S. president signs into law the first major federal gun reform in decades, just weeks after mass shootings in Uvalde and Buffalo killed more than 30 people. Iran's president has slammed a recent anti-Tehran resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors, saying the measure will not force the Islamic Republic to back down from its stance in the Vienna talks.
Negotiations will continue. We don't want to stop the talks, but we have said many times that this resolution cannot force us to back down from a stance. Our negotiators will engage in dignified negotiations to restore the rights of the Iranian people. This has been stressed in meetings with European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell.
In a televised interview, Raisi said the improper resolution was put forward while Iran was in the middle of the JCPOA revival talks and was cooperating fully with the International Atomic Energy Agency. His remarks came shortly after Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, and EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, met in Tehran and announced talks on reviving the 2015 deal will resume in the coming days. Borrell also met the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, told him Iran's remedial measures in the nuclear sector are a legal and rational response to U.S. unilateralism and Europe's inaction. He added Tehran will continue the measures as long as the West's illegal practices are not changed.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agreed today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Professor at the University of Tehran, Fuad Izadi, explains Washington's role in the deadlock in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Take a listen.
Mr. Borrell said there is a deadlock in the talks, And the problem that exists is in Washington. In the U.S. Congress, people, senators, powerful people, oppose U.S. returning to JCPOA. They say this very clearly, both Republicans and Democrats. Robert Menendez, who is the chair of Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, said this in public about 2 weeks ago when he was talking to Robert Malley as the witness that the Senate had invited. So with this chaos in Washington, the opposition to JCPOA is quite severe. There's a lot of politics going on. And if the American officials were honest, they would say that we have internal divisions. We cannot return to JCPOA, and that's going to be a true statement. In reality, that's not what they're saying. They're engaging in this type of blame game. They want to blame Iran for talks not succeeding.
Resistance movements reacting to Israeli plan to create an anti-Iran regional alliance. Lebanon's Hezbollah has rejected claims on forming such an alliance as an empty threat. Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General says the group attaches no importance to the claim, but stays alert to respond to likely threats. Sheikh Naim Qasem pointed to Arab countries that have normalized relations with the regime, saying it's a disgrace for them to want to form a military coalition with Tel Aviv. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the new Israeli plan is much more dangerous than some Arab countries normalizing ties with the occupying regime. The Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said last week the regime is working with Arab states to build a U.S.-led air defense alliance against Iran. On Friday, Jordan's King Abdullah said that he supported the formation of a Middle East alliance similar to the Western-led NATO. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed into law the first major federal gun reform in the country in 3 decades. The House of Representatives had passed the bipartisan bill on Friday following Senate approval. The legislation includes provisions to help states keep guns out of the hands of those deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. It, however, falls short of more restrictive gun control proposals that Democrats favor. The signing of the bill comes just weeks after mass shootings in the U.S. cities of Uvalde and Buffalo that killed more than 30 people, including 19 children at an elementary school. We've asked our correspondent Colin Campbell to explain the bill and restrictions it stipulates. Here's what he had to say.
The bill that President Biden signed calls for tougher background checks, especially for younger gun buyers, those younger than 21. It would provide another layer of security or protection, they say, for someone to buying a gun. What they wanted to prevent here were people who were younger, who would buy a gun in a fit of an emotional state, like what seemed to have happened in Uvalde, where the gun was able to be purchased very quickly and then able to be used in a feeling of whatever emotion the shooter at that time was feeling. And they've seen other cases of this where people have been able to buy guns. I believe also this happened in Oklahoma as well with the shooting there. A man was in pain, back pain, and shot his doctor. And so they're looking at that case and many others that came up with that policy. And then you have what are called red flag laws. These are people who have had a background or a history of some type of mentally compromised action or expression being restricted from buying a gun or anything physical, domestic violence, so on and so forth. So people who may have had a history of violence or reasons why for them to own a gun would be somewhat questionable, those are also in place.
Well, moving on to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, the key battleground city of Severodonetsk in the eastern Donbass region has fallen to Russian forces. The mayor says the city is now in full control of Russian forces. Kiev had already ordered troops to withdraw from Severodonetsk. That marks the biggest retreat by Ukraine since the loss of the southern port city of Mariupol last month. The Russian takeover of the city is also seen as a significant victory for Moscow over Ukraine's eastern commercial hub. The war, which began 4 months ago, is now focused on the eastern Donbass region, with the fall of Severodonetsk. Its adjoining city of Lysychansk is likely to become a new battlefield in the east. Pro-Russian forces say they have entered parts of that city. Johnny Miller joined us earlier with the latest developments on the ground. Let's take a listen.
There was some fear that there was going to be another Azovstal steelworks. What happened there in Mariupol, there was fears that it might happen again in Severodonetsk, with Ukrainian soldiers stationed there or holding out there for many weeks. That hasn't happened. The Russians have taken the chemical plant in Severodonetsk, and now it's fully under their control. Now, Lysychansk is just a kind of adjoined city right next to Severodonetsk. It's on higher ground, but it looks like only a matter of time until the Russians take that as well. It's been a huge withdrawal of Ukrainian troops. There are still troops there, but it looks like Russia will take that probably in the coming days, or this war often seems to be moving slower than many people expected, so it might take another week or so, but it looks like Russia will take Lysychansk, that is inevitable, effectively. And then after that, they look to push down into Donbass.
Protests and strikes continue in Italy as the country is suffering from sharply rising energy costs and growing inflation. Movements and associations representing different layers of society have been staging protests for months, demanding support to the government. Max Civelli reports from Rome.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector. The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month. Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
The Baqi Cemetery is located near the Prophet Muhammad's Mosque in the city of Medina, Saudi Arabia. It holds much significance for Muslims because many of the Prophet Muhammad's relatives and companions were laid to rest there, including four infallible imams. Mahdi Abousian reports.
To the southeast of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina exists a cemetery that is the most famous and holiest in the Islamic world, Jannatul Baqi, meaning the Garden of Heaven, After the dawn prayers, the gates of Bari are opened for a few hours, and crowds of Muslim pilgrims flock to it. Bari is the main burial ground for the people of Medina since the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and contains graves of many of the Prophet Muhammad's family and companions.
In order to describe the importance of Bari Cemetery, I have to say it is a rendezvous of thousands of Muslims every day.
Bari is honored to host the tombs of four infallible Imams, Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon them. Today, there is no trace of the shrine that used to contain their tombs. Close to the graves are the remains of the House of Sorrows, a place where the Prophet's daughter, Lady Fatima, used to come to and shed tears of grief over the loss of her father.
When you enter in Mazari Baqiya, there you become very, you know, emotional.
It is also believed that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, often prayed in Bari whenever he was passing through.
Bari is like no other cemetery in the world of Islam. It's a place of absolute sanctity for all Muslims. Therefore, Hajj pilgrims every year visit this place to pay tribute to the relatives and companions of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism, says Kahan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Faith, Unity, and Resistance Thwarts U.S. Devilish Designs. Stay tuned for more. There is some grain of truth when former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan says that it was U.S. meddling which shoved him out of office last April. In a recent interview to the Sunday Times, he blasted the U.S. for its imperial arrogance, revealing that his ambassador in Washington had received a message from U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for South Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, who had threatened Pakistan with consequences if Imran Khan remained in power as premier. In the past 40 years, our leadership has basically bowed down on everything the U.S. has demanded for us, said the one-time star cricketer who, in 1970s, had captained Pakistan to victory in the World Cup. This hardly seems to be an unfounded claim or an exaggeration when we, in Iran, after ending in 1979, a quarter century of American control over our country, have, over the past 42 years, been exposed to the intensity of U.S. devilish designs through war, invasion, cultural crimes, economic terrorism, political pressures, and the current threats regarding our own inalienable right to enrich uranium for our IAEA-certified peaceful nuclear projects. The U.S., without the least doubt, is the great Satan, and resistance is the only way to defeat it. In order to remain independent, powerful, progressive, unified, self-sufficient, self-dignified, and above all, loyal to Islam and the dynamic teachings of Prophet Muhammad and his immaculate Ahlul Bayt, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In other words, if the Yankees get the slightest chance to yank any of these values, you would simply devour it in the most savage manner. This is evident by the sorry state of affairs in neighboring Afghanistan, which the U.S. occupied for two decades, and now after withdrawal of its troops has not only blocked billions of dollars of Afghan assets, but is actively spreading terrorism through Daesh and similar outfits to further destabilize the country. The same is true for the situation in Iraq, where a government has still not been formed 8 long months after holding the general elections, mainly because of undue American meddling and unabated plunder of the country's vast oil reserves, while the political parties bicker over trivial matters. Syria is another country in our neighborhood which the U.S. destroyed through macabrely murderous terrorists of all hue and color, and continues to destabilize not just through its occupation forces, but also by ordering the Zionist regime to indulge in almost daily aerial attacks for President Bashar al-Assad's refusal to bow to Washington's pressures. Then there is Lebanon, where the resolve of a sizable section of people to remain independent has prompted the U.S. to resort to all sorts of intrigues to try to ruin its economy and political system. Yemen, for the past 7 years, is engulfed in flames of war as a result of its invasion by the U.S. client states of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, whose cultish and clannish regimes do not want peace and stability in the Arabian Peninsula's only country having democratic institutions and not subject to hereditary rule. Palestine, groaning for the past 74 years under the jackboots of the illegal Zionist migrants of Eastern Europe, remains an open wound on human conscience. And there will be no solution to the people's plight even if the resistance groups were to express their readiness to accept the U.S. Zionist yoke. The list of American interference is endless and spread all over the globe, including Europe, Africa, and Latin America, where Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua stand as prime examples of countries subjected to U.S. state terrorism. In view of these undeniable facts, the only solution to thwart U.S. hegemony is to firm up resistance based on genuine Islamic values, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown and has inspired masses in the neighborhood and beyond to stand up to outside pressures through faith, unity, self-confidence, and formation of popular mobilization units, which are all capable of defeating American imperialism.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Brother Sajjad Haida. Brother Sajjad Haida, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, recently we have been seeing several cases of the Quran desecration or the Quran burning all across the world, which is considered a blasphemous action, not only by Muslims, but also by all the, we can say, monotheistic believers and the followers, that disrespecting the holy texts and the holy scriptures of the religions, especially Abrahamic religions like Islam, is a blasphemous action. First of all, Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you. What are the main intentions or the reasons of these extremists doing so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the main reason is ignorance, ignorance, and ignorance. And this is the pure reason for burning the Quran, for insulting others. And obviously, where the Quran, when we talk about the Quran, it's a holy book, you know. We talk about the Bible as a holy book.
Yes.
The Torah as a holy book. You know, there are four holy books.
Yes.
Although there are the deviations, although there are changes in the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, but still you will not see any Muslim burning these books.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we are aware of these books, that these books were the books of guidance. Yes, people have changed it. On the other hand, the problem is that because people are unaware of the text of the Quran, and what they know is what is being told to them, what is being propagated. Maybe there was a speaker who basically talked wrongly about the book, who gave the wrong picture of the book. That's why some people like they do this. That's the one reason. The other reason is because of being the enemy, you know, enmity.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that is that because this book is book of guidance, this book has come to bring justice in the society. Therefore, you know, the so-called rulers of the world, or those who want to, you know, gain everything for themselves, who do not, you know, do not care about the justice, the rights of the people, because this book is making people aware of these things, so this book has become the enemy of them.
Okay.
And therefore, they purposefully do this.
That's right.
And that's why we see, like, there are some people who are purposefully spreading the Islamophobia in in the world.
Okay.
And this is purposefully is being done. And these are the main reasons. These are the two main reasons.
And unfortunately, there is this wrong interpretation and understanding of some of the people in the world that the extremists' action, like, for example, Al-Qaeda or Daesh, ISIS, you know, are taking their teachings from the text of the Holy Quran. And this is, I think, a wrong understanding, isn't it?
They're not taking. They're being given. Oh. You know, this is, we need to understand that. These are the plotted people.
Plotted people, that's
These are plotted people. The wrong translations are given. Now, let me talk about the translation. I said just the translation.
Okay.
The Quran was firstly translated into Turkish language. When we look at the history of the
bilingual translations
that we have.
Okay.
It was initially was translated into Turkey, and then the Ottoman Empire. Like, they've stopped people from reading the Arabic text. And they said everyone needs to read the translation so they can understand. After that, the Turkish translation of the Quran was later translated from Turkish to French. And after that, from French, someone translated into the English.
English language. That's
so the main problem is, you know, in the translations is that when you translate something from another language, which is not the original language, the things are being changed.
That's right.
You know, the message has been, you know, you lose the message. So the English translations initially that we had, the main issue was, and still we have some of them, is been translated from the Turkish to French and French to English.
That's right.
Whereas it is not Arabic to English directly.
Okay.
And therefore, the translator never knows what it's been said in Arabic.
Right.
Whereas for the Arabic language, we say, for example, you know, even one word has many meanings. For example, there is one letter, letter B, which is like equivalent to B.
Yes.
It has 22 meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which meaning we need to use, which meaning it's been used, the context of the, you know, sentence.
That's right.
They have ignored it. So these are the issues that we have faced and through which there were many people who became ignorant towards the actual text of the Quran.
Of the Quran, that's all right. So, Brother Sajjad Haidar, what do you think the main reason is for the desecration of the holiest text of the Muslims, that is the text of the Holy Quran?
Well, the first thing I would like to say is that even in any standard, in any human standard, no one will going to accept the reality that you have the right to demolish and destroy something which is against your belief. This kind of mentality that if you give the spreading of this mentality that you will try to destroy anything which is against your belief, then the human society will become a jungle where the people will kill each other just because they are different in their ideas and thoughts. So there is no doubt that based on some not just religious perspective, but based on a human perspective in general, we have no right to do such an action against any kind of idea which is against my belief.
Okay.
This is the first thing which I like to say.
Okay.
The second thing which I think is influential, especially if you give a touch to the political the side of this, that why the governments are letting such thing happen.
Yes.
I think that...
Sorry, some of the countries even legalized
it. That's what I am saying. So... You know that the Quran has a charm, it has attraction. So anyone when he reads Quran is himself attracted towards Quran. So if you go to the research to study these cases where people were converted to Islam, many of them said just by reading Quran we know the reality that what beautiful book this is.
Yes.
So how to stop this? There are people who are thinking how to stop this book. So one of the sources is to spread the propaganda about the Quran that this is so that they may not read the book.
Yes.
So such actions, I think they may have the some plotting and some conspiracies behind them. So no doubt that to stop the people from reading such books or to stop people from to come to dialogue
that's
instead
right.
of so maybe there are such aims such goals there. Maybe they are influential in such actions.
And what do you think the solution is? Because when the Quran is burnt, you know, sometimes we see the harsh opposition or confrontation from the side of the Muslims too. Instead of, for example, answering them in a logical way. Whose responsibility is this, and what is the responsibility of the Muslim scholars? I mean, in order to answer the doubts and the questions regarding the holy text of the Quran. Because for so many non-Muslims and the atheists and the non-believers in any religion, the text of the Holy Quran is like a book and not the Word of God, the Almighty. So whose responsibility is this to make them understand that this is the Word of God?
Well, the first thing is on the shoulders of the governments.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing and for sure.
Okay.
For example, if you're in France, can you burn the flag of the France in front of the parliament?
Oh, no.
If you do so, there are consequences. Yes. So France says like you have a freedom of speech.
Yes.
If someone says it is my feeling,
mm-hmm.
I want to express my feeling, I have a freedom of speech, and I want to burn the flag of France in front of the parliament, and the government should not say anything to me, this cannot be happened. Why? Because there are some red lines.
That's right.
There's a limitation.
Okay.
Similarly, when we talk about the religion, the books of those religions, the personalities of the religion, for example, the prophets and the books, these are the red lines for the yes. followers of for some religions.
Okay.
Therefore, it is the responsibility of the governments to stop people from doing such actions. And obviously, those who have legalized, obviously, they yes. are ignorant towards this and they're purposefully doing something. They're following the propaganda of the enemies, basically.
Yes.
And this is the duty of the governments, first of all.
Yes.
If they want peace in the society, they have to do this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they do not ban this thing, if they do not stop their people, if they do not make their people aware of it,
yes.
then obviously they will have the riots, they will have the protests, they will have the misconducts in the society, and that will result in a non-peaceful or unpeaceful society.
That's right.
At the end. So okay. this is the duty of them. The second thing is the duty of the religious, we can say, personalities, the speakers, the scholars.
Yes.
Who needs to talk about it, who needs to tell them. Obviously, when we do dialogue, even when we talk to someone in the Quran, even we have that, do not abuse the idols. Mm-hmm. This is the verse of the Quran.
Yes.
Do not use bad words for the idols, because if you do so, they will use the bad words for your real God. That is the real, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when Quran is stopping the Muslims from having such a, action against the non-Muslims, then obviously it means that the Islam is not in the favor of such things. And it is against all yes. these, we can say like extreme
activities
that are happening.
Okay.
So this is the duty of the government. This is the duty of the scholars, not only Muslim scholars, mm-hmm. but the Christians and the other scholars who are in the, because, there are many people who come to the media on the TV. There are different mm-hmm. shows
yes.
where the scholars or the, experts, they come yes. and they talk about it.
Yes.
So they have to talk about the peace.
Okay.
They have to spread peace. And if someone okay. does not like something, you should not go towards that.
They say that the popularity of the religion of Islam is increasing. And in the last decade, the documents and the statistics show that the followers and the conversion into the religion of Islam, I'm talking about the true Islam, is very much all across the world. So such plots and conspiracies, like burning the Quran by, for example, a priest or something like that, even without reading it, because somebody asked the priest, I think his name was Terry Jones or something like that, mm-hmm. who burned the Quran. I said, did you read it at all? He said, no need to reading. Okay, how is it possible not to read the Quran and then burn it? Okay, so as Sayyid said at the beginning of the program, it shows all the ignorance. Okay, Brother Sajjad Haider, anything, any point about the Holy Quran and the desecration?
Well, I think that Quran itself as a whole is a... is a proof for itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know that any intellectual work, whether it's any written book, if it's a universal reality, that any book after one or two centuries, it is challenged its content because new realities come, human with it, the course of their intellectual perfection, they know new realities, and they say the person who has written a book one century ago, it was its challenge, and many of its contents proved to be wrong.
Okay.
But you see, there is a book which is written in nearly more than 14 centuries ago, and it still challenges human mind, and it's just a miracle, as you know. No one can get any, no one can challenge Quran in its content. So it's still a challenge for it itself. Quran as a whole is a challenge for human. It's a proof for its own being right and being from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that its challenge, its content cannot be challenged by anyone. Maybe this is one of the reasons that that's why the opponents, the people who are against Quran, instead of coming with the intellectual work, they are inclined towards burning it.
Yes.
So that's one of the proofs of its being strong.
That's right. And I think it's a heavy responsibility on the shoulders of the Muslims to defend their own books. So I think one weak point maybe from the side of the Muslims is maybe their lack of information about the Quran too, okay? So for example, I as a Muslim must have enough knowledge about my text. So if somebody tries to burn it, I can defend it. And I can read the text of the Holy Quran in Arabic, translated it, you know, and talk about the most important parts of the Quran. So sometimes I think this is the problem from the side of the Muslims. The Muslims, I mean the public, okay?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. The main responsibility, I think, lies on the shoulders of Muslims themselves. Because there are two aspects I'd like to say.
Okay, very good.
The first aspect is regarding their character. By our own practice, we should enlighten people.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a Muslim, I'm living in any country in the world, with my actions, with my deeds, I will show the world that a person who is obeying Quran is such a person. So
that's
he may enlighten people with his action, as the Holy Prophet used to do. And the second thing, it's the duty of the intellectuals, Muslim intellectuals, or any reasonable personalities and intellectuals in the world, to tell people that Quran is what a great book, and
that's
they
right.
should, even if they don't believe, they should once read this book.
That's
I remember
right.
in one of the lectures in one of the prominent, I think it was a university there, and one of the prominent scholars of philosophy and Quranic studies in the West, he asked the audience that. Any one of you had experience of reading Quran, and there was none
mm-hmm.
in the audience who
right.
had read the Quran. So it's, I think, the second duty lies
yes.
on the intellectuals, that
That's
they
right.
should clarify and enlighten people about the reality and beauty
okay.
of Quran.
And those non-Muslims who were interested in reading out the text of the Quran were changed. And most of them
converted,
say that
yes.
reading the text of the Holy Quran made us convert into the religion
yeah,
of Islam.
It captures it. Actually,
okay.
it has a,
yes.
such a power.
Okay. That's all right.
Any
yep.
point? One last point is that, you know, when we talk about Islam, obviously Islam is a religion.
Yes.
We need to know about it. And that is the only book. It has only one book, and that is Quran.
Yes.
And also Supreme Leader also has said, like, if you want to the West, youth of the West, that if you want to know about the religion, know about from the main sources, which is Quran. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, when we see burning the Quran, opposing the Islam and all those things, they're because of one reason, and that is, when we look at the Quran, this is for the listeners. When you look at the Quran, when you go inside the Quran, you see that Quran is opposing some people.
Okay.
Number one, oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
Zalimin.
Zalimin, that's right.
Yeah. Number two, ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number three, obviously, those who want every, like, all the reserves for themselves. The capitalism, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And those who want everything, the greedy ones.
Mm-hmm.
So Quran is actually opposing these people.
That's right.
And today, if we see some people are coming and burning the Quran, it means that they are the oppressors. They do not want the message of the Quran to be spread against them.
Yes.
They are the greedy ones who wants everything for them. You know, we had 99% protesting against one person in Wall Street. They were ruling over the world. So the reserves, the wealth of the world should be distributed according to justice amongst the people, whereas there are some people who want everything.
why we see the existence of such countries, some That's countries right. in the Arab countries, because of their oil, their reserves, and all those things.
Yes.
And they went to America even. The actual red Americans, like red Indians, like they were actual American natives, they even do not have the government in their hand right now in the USA. So basically, because Quran has opposed directly the oppressors, the zalimeen, the those who want everything for themselves, that's why these people have come to fight with the Quran, and they found one way, and that is by burning the Quran, mm-hmm. or maybe this way they can spread a kind of phobia or mm-hmm. hatred against the Quran. Mm-hmm. Whereas obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He has revealed the Quran, yes. He is the protector of the Quran till yes. Qiyamah, and this will be remain, inshallah.
Inshallah. Unfortunately, this burning the Quran made some people in order to go and see what is Quran, okay? So this whatness of the Quran and the question in the minds attracts the people of reading out the Quran, and Allah is the main protector of the holy text of the Quran up until the Day of Judgment, inshallah. Thank you, Amar Sayyid Mohsen Nawi and Brother Sajjad Haider, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com / EN Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address Israeli regime's action as such, says Emily Hacker, writer, in an article published under the heading, Israeli regime's assaults on public health infrastructure amount to war crimes. Stay tuned for more. In May 2021, the Zionist regime military dropped hundreds of bombs on the Gaza Strip, destroying houses, schools, businesses, and healthcare facilities. Perhaps nowhere was the human toll of that month more apparent than at Al-Shifa Hospital, the only hospital in Gaza equipped for emergency assistance. Doctors worked for days on end, rarely sleeping or eating, and unable to see their families as they frantically treated hundreds of wounded Palestinian patients, at least those patients who could actually reach the hospital. Outside the hospital grounds, streets were so badly damaged by the Zionist regime's airstrikes that paramedics struggled to bring patients directly to Al-Shifa. In the span of those 11 days in May, the Zionist regime occupation forces wreaked havoc on Gaza's already precarious public health system, damaging or destroying 19 medical centers, including the offices of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, a nonprofit that provides cancer treatment and medical prosthetics to children who are unable to seek care outside of Gaza due to Israeli regime blockade. The Israeli regime's military actions in 2021 were, unfortunately, nothing new. Numerous Israeli bombing campaigns have damaged or destroyed primary health infrastructure in the occupied Gaza Strip, including clinics and hospitals, as well as key public health services like water treatment facilities, sewage treatment plants, and electrical grids. This is not accidental. The Zionist regime relies on, among other strategies, the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, the targeting of medical personnel, and inhibiting Palestinian access to healthcare to enforce its regime of apartheid. Yet, Western health officials often overlook these acts, which are nothing short of war crimes, and this passive complicity violates promise as healthcare professionals to do no harm. The physical and mental health of the Palestinian people is a central component of Palestinian liberation and must be discussed as such. The Zionist regime's military offensives against Palestine have both created and exacerbated existing public health concerns within the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Beginning with the Nakba in 1948, the Israeli regime has made it a matter of policy to destroy not only Palestinian homes and communities, but clinics, hospitals, and other health infrastructure. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza in 2021 damaged or destroyed numerous clinics, a water treatment facility, and infrastructure related to COVID-19 testing and treatment. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza were injured during the Zionist regime's May 2021 military assault, and hospitals were overwhelmed. The outright destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, such as the bombing of a clinic operated by Doctors Without Borders, is accompanied by direct physical violence against healthcare personnel. The Israeli regime military have killed medical professionals, including doctors Ayman Abu Al-Auf and Mo'in Al-Aul in 2021, and paramedic Razan Al-Najjar, who was killed by Israeli snipers in 2018. Often, leaders and pillars of their communities, doctors killed by the Israeli regime military, leave behind both a physical and psychological void of healthcare and security. The actions of the fake regime of Israel and occupying military forces are indefensible by any interpretation and international humanitarian law, yet they are ignored at every opportunity by world leaders. In no other country and in no other war could such actions be left unaddressed by the Western medical community. Along with the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure and the targeted killings of Palestinian healthcare workers, the Israeli regime imposes draconian restrictions on the movement of Palestinians seeking healthcare in Gaza and the West Bank. Medical travel permits are often delayed, lost, or ignored by Israeli regime occupation forces operating checkpoints out of Gaza. Figures from the World Health Organization estimate that the Israeli regime and military accepted only 54% of medical travel permits in 2017. Blockades and checkpoints operated by Israeli regime occupation forces grossly impede not only the day-to-day freedoms of Palestinians, but prevent ambulances from transporting critically ill and injured patients. Despite the close proximity of the Israeli and Palestinian populations, infant and maternal mortality rates remain markedly higher for Palestinians, and life expectancy is almost 10 years shorter. The rates of stroke, hypertension, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and neonatal disorders range from 3 to 7 times higher for Palestinians as compared with Israelis. This is by design. The Israeli regime has removed or prevented the construction of systems of care and residences, denying building permits and demolishing homes. Living under a regime of occupation and apartheid carries with it a heavy physical toll, one that cannot be adequately expressed through statistics. Bodily integrity and bodily health are identified as key components to individual prosperity. The right of self-determination and Palestinian liberation are incumbent upon the general health of the Palestinian population, both of which the Zionist regime aims to destroy. The healthcare workers and public health personnel living and working under Israeli regime occupation are a testament to Palestinian strength and resistance, and public health officials in Palestine must have their calls to action echoed by their colleagues internationally. Outside of Palestine, healthcare professionals should be among the first to apply pressure to Western regimes to end funding absent a change of Israeli regime behavior and to condemn and uncover Israeli war crimes. Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address the Zionist regime action as such.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.